Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
You're listening to the Talking Metal Podcast with your host, Mark Striegel, and special guest co-host, Victor M. Ruiz. iTunes number one hard rock and metal podcast. I'm Bud Friendly. Now, here are your hosts, Mark and Victor.
Welcome, one and all, to another edition of Talking Metal Live. I am Victor from Mars Attacks over in Spain, and over in New Jersey, we have Mark Striegel.
Yo, how are you?
Good, how you doing, Mark?
Good, it's been a little bit of chaos going on here in the house. My wife was out at the store, and it takes me like 10, 15 minutes to get everything set up, because I don't leave all my equipment set up. So I was frazzled. I'm still a little frazzled, but it sounds like we are live and everything is going across the stream, and we have a handful of listeners joining us. So hello to you guys and hello to you, Victor. And I'm about to crack open my first beer of the evening.
This is a transatlantic toast, I guess you could say. Although... I've got the Gatorade. Unfortunately, no beer for me tonight.
Any particular reason why?
Gastroenteritis, or whatever it's called. Stomach bug. So.
Right. So, but do you have like a fever and stuff too, or just?
No, just my stomach's been bugging me all week. Went to the doctor's this morning, and they told me to lay off eating for a good part of the day and just have Gatorade and other similar things. So that's socialist medicine for you.
Well, we just had Mike Melenda, I think the guy's name is. Do you know that guy?
He writes me all the time, especially when I put up the classic albums columns. He's a big fan of that and always comments on the albums, and he's always been pretty supportive. So we appreciate your support.
Yeah, he actually just made a nice PayPal donation. So a big thanks to Mike Melenda for doing that. That's his name, right? Mike Melenda?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So he just checked in on Facebook, which you guys can do right now, too. You guys can check in with me on Facebook, on the Talking Metal page, on the Talking Metal digital page, on Facebook.com/mstriegel. I'm checking them all as we do the live show. I am also on the Talking Metal Twitter account, which is twitter.com/talkingmetal. Let's make the hashtag nice and simple for tonight. How about just hashtag Talking Metal? So I will be checking all those throughout the night. And Mike checked in with a donation, and I wanted to play a song for him. You want to start the evening off doing that, Victor? And then you and I will come back and chat a little more.
Sure. Perfect.
How about a little Pantera going out to Mike right now? This is Tens.
Mm-hmm.
Back as usual, a little clip of the next song, I guess, to wet your whistle there.
Yeah, you know, we clean these up when they go out in podcast form, so you know, yeah. Just we're still working out the kinks here with the live show. I know I've been saying that for the last few months, but it's not like we're doing these every day. You know, we do them once a week, maybe once every other week sometimes, so excuse me, we're still working things out, so thanks for bearing with us. And I know the last live show I posted as a podcast, Victor, your mic was getting clipped quite a bit. So hopefully we'll avoid that this time. And yeah, thanks for bearing with us, guys. And as we work out all the technical issues with these live shows, which then go on to become podcasts.
Absolutely. This is all a work in progress. And, you know, hopefully it will be a finely tuned machine in no time.
Definitely. So let's talk about the news, not just heavy metal news. What was one of the big stories this week in the news, Victor?
Definitely the Rolling Stone cover. Rolling Stone, and it's funny because I saw this on Facebook when people started posting about it. And the first sort of post that caught my eye was someone saying, "Oh, Rolling Stone, cutting edge as usual." And it was just sort of
like
an odd...
Was it they being sarcastic?
No, I think this comes back to a Seinfeld quote. It seemed like a hipster doofus that was posting this. Because, I mean, the whole thing... The person's comment was about how ahead of the game Rolling Stone was and how edgy they are and everything else. And, you know, I sort of thought of it... And first of all, a lot of the comments that people like Nikki Sixx and Dave from Device and Disturbed have made are similar to what I thought. You know, I do think that it's a bit of, you know, discouraging to not only bands for, you know, that strive to be on the cover, but also to the families and victims that were involved in this bombing. You know, I think if you look back to 9/11. Rolling Stone didn't have Osama bin Laden on the cover. Didn't have.
I guess in defense, though, they were saying, "Well, a lot of magazines did have Osama bin Laden on the cover."
Right, but you know, I think this honestly comes down to a certain sector of the population right now that see this kid as sort of a hero for some reason. You know, they see him as, you know, plain clothes. He isn't like a Muhammad Atta that, you know, had not only the various religious beliefs, but he also dressed, you know, a certain way. This kid obviously dressed like any everyday high schooler or someone that, you know, is fresh out of high school and in college. He's, you know, again, going towards that sort of hipster chic look. And there's actually been, you know, a bunch of people reporting that he's got all these groupies. So I honestly think that they're sort of, you know, trying to tailor to that, if at all possible.
Yeah, I heard the thing about the groupies, too. And it's really disturbing. I mean, I don't know. Exciter posted, you know, John, who used to run the Talking Metal forums, posted on his Twitter thing, "Phony outrage is still high over the Rolling Stone cover. The sheep will grab internet pitchforks and torches for anything." And I don't know. I don't get it. I think John's a smart guy, so I'm not. I'd like to figure out more about what he's saying. But I think Rolling Stone just, you know, first of all, I don't like the magazine. I never have. And I think it just goes to show what I've always said about their taste in music, that they're so out of touch with reality and with the rest of the country. And, you know, when you put, you know, in modern times, the Strokes and the Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs on the cover, when you could be putting bands, which I don't necessarily like, but Disturbed or Nickelback or something like that on the cover, which are the bands that are actually selling records, but they choose not to do that. They choose to do what they think is cool, and they're not in touch with the feelings and the pulse of the country, and in my opinion, never have been. That goes all the way back to, you know, when they were putting the Velvet Underground on the cover, or were, you know, excited about whoever, some, you know, folk singer that was in the, you know, Greenwich Village somewhere. You know, it's like, I don't know. You know, it's like, I just never really got Rolling Stone. And we all know that they've always, I use the word hate, they've always hated heavy metal music.
Right. Well, back to that Motley Crue cover that is, you know, a lot of people have talked about this week because of Nikki Sixx commenting, where it says something to the extent of heavy metal, it's loud, it's hard, and it'll never go away. Or it's loud, it's ugly, and it'll never go away. So something to that extent.
Yeah.
So it's like, are you serious? So, you know, one of the only times that they put a hard rock or metal band on their cover, and it's still, you know, a jab at, you know, the genre. And as you're saying, you know, for better or for worse, you know, do you like Disturbed or Nickelback or some of these other bands? You know, whatever, but, you know, they want to be, again, ahead of the curve with all these bands that, you know, just look at New York Radio. K-Rock, you know, sort of went that route with the Strokes and all these bands. And, you know, they no longer play any sort of rock-related music. Why? Because they weren't playing anything that was actually selling or that people were actually listening to.
Yeah, totally. And it's like, you know, you look at the guy behind in Rolling Stone magazine, and he also happens to be the guy behind the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, or one of the guys behind it. So it's no surprise that, you know, a magazine that's always hated Kiss and maybe has occasionally done a report on him here and there in an effort to gain some readership. But it's no surprise that the guy who hates bands like Kiss or like Foreigner or anything like that would also not allow these bands in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's really shocking that Rush did get in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you know, and even Led Zeppelin constantly got bad reviews in Rolling Stone magazine until they went back and revised those reviews in more recent times.
Well, the thing there, first with Rush, they were voted in by fans, so it wasn't actually the same panel that voted them in. With Zeppelin, though, I mean, to me, that's no different than what they did with Van Halen or Guns N' Roses. They were looking for that big payday of being able to say, oh, you know, we reunited, you know, Zeppelin. We reunited VH. We reunited Guns N' Roses. And out of all of those, you know, the Van Halen and Guns N' Roses debacles, you know, blew up right in their face. You know, they were expecting a big payday, and they got nothing out of it.
Yeah. And you know, it's like even David Bowie, who I know is not heavy metal or even hard rock for that matter, but he did not go when they inducted him, which I thought, you know, because and he issued a statement that he just simply didn't believe in the whole thing, which I thought was something they really needed to hear, because, you know, all those guys on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame board, they think Bowie's amazing, and he is. He's a true artist, but I just thought it was great that he didn't give in to their BS, you know. And Madonna showed up there to induct him, and he wasn't even there, which I thought was great.
That's awesome. I did not know that, but yeah, I mean, Bowie's always been a Rolling Stone darling.
Yeah.
It's funny, though. I've always mentioned how, you know, as you're saying, that they've turned their back on certain styles of music. But the further we get along, you know, as time goes by, there are so many bands from the 80s that they haven't even inducted yet. I mean, if you think about it, they inducted Metallica, they inducted Guns N' Roses, and there's a whole plethora of bands that sold a shitload of albums that they've, you know, turned a blind eye to.
Oh, yeah. They'll never induct Def Leppard. You know, they should. They're never going to induct John Bon Jovi. At least I think not. Although, because John Bon Jovi is, you know, such a big supporter of liberal causes and, you know, it hangs out with the boss, maybe they will induct John Bon Jovi. But you're saying anyways, now that the fans vote, is that like moving forward how it's going to work?
Apparently, there's one vote or one inductee that's now voted by the fans, and that's how Rush got in.
Oh.
They were
wonder if Kiss would then get in somehow. I don't know.
If I remember correctly, I think Kiss was the third or fourth most voted band on the same list, and they really didn't. Obviously, you weren't aware of this taking place. They obviously didn't make a big deal out of it. I'm wondering if from going forward, you know, all of these bands that they've turned their backs on, like Kiss, Maiden, Priest, Deep Purple, UFO, and so many others that you mentioned as well.
Yeah, Deep Purple. I mean, Deep Purple, that's insane, you know, that they're not in there. From, you know, the pre-Gillan stuff, you know, they had the big hit with Hush, you know, through the course of the just, you know, groundbreaking and cornerstone of hard rock and heavy metal music, if not just rock in general. You know, those albums like In Rock were just so important to the history of rock music, and the fact that they're not there is absolutely amazing. Fireball, you know, there's so many just great records that they put out that were so important. Mike Millett, so how do we pronounce Mike's name? Is it Melada. I was saying Melinda before, but that's not right. It's Melada. Mike Melada.
Melada, okay. Melada.
Yeah, anyways, he is checking in on Facebook right now, and he says, I agree with everything about Rolling Stone magazine. I really got pissed off with them for putting Eddie Van Halen at number 70 for the best hard rock guitar player. Or the best rock guitar player. Yeah, that's absolutely Joke. Ridiculous. Sorry, we're mispronouncing your name. It's Mike
Melada.
Melada. Yeah, Mike Melada. So, Mike, you are totally right about that Rolling Stone list where they pick the best guitar players. I mean, it was just ridiculous. Eddie Van Halen, I mean, I understand, all right, the guy from Sonic Youth or whatever, you know, they want to say, well, he's an artist with his guitar, you know, but to put a bunch of dopey, how could there be 70 people ahead of Van Halen? In my opinion, Van Halen should probably be number one. I mean, maybe Hendrix, because Hendrix really took the guitar to a whole nother level. I mean, right. I guess there's like jazz guys. I mean, you know, even you could say, you know, Muddy Waters was one of the first electric guitar players. Robert Johnson. I think all those guys were important. But Eddie Van Halen is a top five, in my opinion. And in anybody who knows anything about music would have him in the top 10 for sure.
Right. I agree.
Number 70? That's ridiculous.
Yeah,
is that actually right, Mike? I got to Google that.
Is that actually right?
I believe so. And they had like Zach Wilde in the 90s. They had Jack White, I think, was like number 7, which, you know, I dig the White Stripes and all, but for him to be, you know, in the top 10 is just ludicrous. I mean, I'm not the biggest Hendrix fan, but I do understand, you know, his importance throughout the whole grand scheme of things. If you want to look at revolutionary or pioneering players, you know, Hendrix and Eddie Van Halen have to be right up there. And I mean, as much as I dislike Clapton, you know, I don't know, I guess you have to throw him in there in the top 5 for his work with Cream. And, you know, I guess it's arguable, you know, Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page, and Pete Townsend as far as, you know, the most influential players possibly ever, you know, with those guys, because everything sort of spawned.
I don't think that's right. I'm looking at a list right now that's a Rolling Stone best guitar player list, and Eddie's at number 8.
They've done a few. There's one where he's really, really low.
This is Eddie's at 8. Let's see who they have on this list. Who's ahead? Chuck Berry's 7. B.B. King 6. Jeff Beck 5. I mean, I put Eddie above Jeff Beck. I love Jeff Beck. Keith Richards 4. Jimmy Page 3. Eric Clapton 2. And Jimi Hendrix 1. I put Eddie at number 1 or possibly 2 on my list, but.
Right. I would agree with you 100%. I mean, if I'm going with my favorites, I mean, I'd put him at 1. I'd put Page at 2, honestly.
Right. Crazy stuff. Anyways. So I guess a lot of people are now talking about, well, they put, you know, Charlie Manson on the cover back in the day.
Right.
And I will say this. The thing about Charlie Manson was, he did, he was responsible for this horrific crime, or at least he was responsible for convincing people to do a horrific crime. Isn't that how it worked out? I'm not sure.
Right. Yeah.
But, he did, in a weird way, I don't know what the article was like about him, and I don't even know what the article is like about this Boston bomber guy, but just the fact that you put this cute kid on the cover as opposed to a picture of him looking all beat up and mangled or in jail or something that isn't like this cutesy little picture. I think that's the problem. And with Manson, you know, this probably doesn't make much sense, but he was sort of tied in with the music world. Like, he tried out for the Monkees and he wrote songs. Not that he still probably should have never been put on the cover or glamorized in any magazine, but in some weird way, he was kind of connected to the music world. And I think back in those days, Rolling Stone was more of a music magazine than it's become nowadays.
Yeah, some people have argued, you know, why didn't they put the picture of him all bloodied from the boat on the cover? Which,
yeah,
if you want to say, you know, he's a monster, this or that, exactly what you're saying. Instead of having a shot that glamorizes him, have one that actually shows, you know, similar to Manson, a beat up Manson in a orange jumpsuit, you know?
Totally. Well, maybe we should get into a little music.
Yep. A song that, I guess this came before the whole Manson thing. And apparently he used this as sort of a guide to do what he did at that point in time. I mean, I've never fully understood the story. But,
yeah. Oh, and real quick, Mike just sent me a link, and yeah, they definitely did have on one of their lists, they had Eddie at number 70, which is just
a crime.
It's an outrage. It's ridiculous. It's just, you know, and you know what it is? It's like stupidity.
Yeah, it's similar to everything else that we've mentioned. And again, the only reason that they're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is because they thought they would be the guys that reunited the four original members.
Yeah.
So,
anyways, yeah, a little Helter Skelter.
There we go. We are back. Little Helter Skelter there from Motley Crue. First time I ever heard that song was in a commercial advertising for the band playing at, I think it was Nassau Coliseum.
Oh, interesting. So, yeah, that was, it's weird. I kind of got into that song, and that led me back to the original version by the Beatles, which a lot of people don't like the Motley Crue version. I still love it.
Yeah, me too. It's funny. Years later, I remember listening to SOU and hearing someone doing, you know, Helter Skelter and saying, wow, these guys are doing a very bad ripoff of the Motley Crue version. And it ended up being the Aerosmith version off of Pandora's Box. So
some tweets coming in. John Bonham, a.k.a. handle Metallica underscore 87, is saying he's still, let's see, what the hell is he saying? He's saying he still listens as well. I don't know if he's talking about the live show, but due to other things, I don't listen to the podcast anymore. Miss the forums. But due to other things, I'm not sure what that means, John. Sorry you're not listening to the podcast anymore. I don't know if that means you're listening live, but if you are, thanks for listening live. And John, a.k.a. Exciter, is listening. Haven't had much to say. He will use a better forum to explain himself. Maybe he's talking about his Rolling Stone comment, which was phony outrage is still high over the Rolling Stone cover. The sheep will grab internet pitchforks and torches for anything. Cool. So anyways, next topic, right, Victor?
Yeah. And I, before jumping onto that, I do have to say I'm disappointed in John that he didn't bust out his famous word sheeple.
Sheeple with John Bonham or John Exciter?
Exciter.
Oh, okay.
Combination of sheep and people. He used to always say that on the forum, sheeple.
Cool. Guys, we are on Twitter talking live with you guys. The hashtag is simply talking metal. And that hashtag is good actually for the podcast too. So if you want to get involved in a talking metal conversation on Twitter, just use that talking metal hashtag and we will chat for sure.
Cool. So I wanted to touch upon the whole Spotify controversy this week. I wanted to bring it up with you because you were the first real person that I had heard really talking Spotify up. I knew of people, you know, that had been using it, but you were actually the first person that I heard make a valid argument for actually using Spotify over CDs and other things. And obviously, in the news this week is Thom Yorke of Radiohead and a producer who mentioned that Spotify isn't good for young acts because they don't get paid fuck all, is what they posted on Twitter regarding how they feel that Spotify works. They more or less allude to the fact that it works well for established artists, but not for new bands that are trying to promote their albums.
Right. You know, I see both sides of this argument, but my whole thing that I have arrived at in more recent times is I really think the day of selling a full-length album, which usually didn't contain more than one or two good songs, but you had to go out and buy it, is a thing of the past. And whenever I say that, people are like, that's not true. In the 70s and 80s, albums were so much better. They weren't. You just remember the good ones. They were just as bad, if not worse, than they are now. Yeah, and Led Zeppelin and Tool and Metallica and David Bowie, these are bands I think put out a lot of perfect albums that you could listen to all the way through. But you got to remember, they were hundreds of thousands of other records that were coming out in the 70s every year and the 80s, and they were all crap. Most of them didn't have one good song on them. And then there were the bands, you know, that had, you know, they had one good song, and so many hard rock and heavy metal bands fall into that category where you had to go buy the whole record just to, because a lot of times these songs weren't released as 45s and you had to go, or cassette singles, and you had to go buy the whole record for one song. And we got ripped off for years. And I think that business model was, what's the word? An anomaly. Is that the right word? You know, it was just like this strange thing that existed for a brief amount of time from, you know, the mid 60s through, you know, I don't know what, like 2000.
Yeah. Around there, around when Napster sort of came about.
And I think that business model is gone. And I think back, you know, my great uncle was a radio guy in Buffalo, New York. His name was Bob Striegel. And when he was an engineer, he'd run the equipment, he'd run the boards, he sang, he, you know, played piano, and he was like, you know, and then he went out and he did news reports too. Like when the, I forget that, what's that Rainbow Bridge or whatever opened between Niagara Falls and Canada, you know, America and Canada. He was there for the opening of that, reporting live. And so anyways, he was like a jack of all trades radio guy. And when like Bing Crosby would come through town, Bing Crosby would be playing a show in Buffalo, and he'd go into the radio station there in Buffalo, and he'd sing live on the air, many times using the local, you know, musicians that worked at the station. And he'd sing live on the air to promote his song, or his show, I'm sorry, that night. And he wasn't selling records. He wasn't. There, no one was buying records at that time. He was promoting a show. That's how the musicians made their money, by performing live. So I think that, you know, the idea that you make records and you get rich that way, it isn't working right now. Maybe the times will change and it'll come back. Maybe it's a good thing people like Tom York are fighting for it. But the flip side of it is that it's just not realistic in these times where, you know, grabbing music is so easy, whether it's legally or illegally, which is, you know, I mean, they should be selling downloads on iTunes for like 25 cents a song.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you. Whenever the whole, you know, argument comes up, and I've asked a lot of different artists, is the album format dead? And a lot of them say, oh, no, you know, I'm putting out an album and this and that, and okay, I understand that, but especially older groups that are, you know, going out on tour and just playing one song off of the album live, I mean, what's the point in even recording entire album?
Yeah, there's no point. And the way Motley Crue did it last year was the correct way. They put out one single and they went and they did a tour. And that's what Bumblefoot has hinted that Guns N' Roses should do. That's what Bruce Dickinson has hinted he'd like to do with Maiden, or maybe it was Adrian Smith, one of those guys, I can't remember. But that's what should be happening, is, and that's, you know, that's how it was back before big business started, you know, forcing us to buy full length records. That's how it was. You know, you'd release a song, one song. There wasn't this whole thing. And you know what? Tom York I like Tom York. Some Talking Metal listeners will probably be very disappointed in that, but I've seen Radiohead in concert numerous times. I love Radiohead, and they pull it off. They put out a good record, and it's a piece of art, their record. But most people can't do that, and it's like, and you don't need to do it anymore. So maybe Tom York should not put his stuff on Spotify, because he can put out good records, and a guy like me will actually go buy the CD of it, you know. So I don't know. Why he should just, I think he should just, if he doesn't like Spotify, do what Tool does. Don't sell your music there, you know.
Right. And it's funny,
I guess he's saying they don't make any money from it anyways. So don't put your music there is what I'm
saying. Well, Gizbutt is the name of a guy who used to play in the Prodigy. Excuse me. He played on their Fat of the Land CD, and he's probably best known for his guitar work on the song Firestarter. He has a band called The More I See, which I've actually interviewed Peter Ellis, who was the third lead singer in White Wizard, and he was the original lead singer of The More I See. Anyway, he's pretty much said that he thinks that Tom York has come across this decision because he's sort of becoming an old man that's scared of technology. And he's also saying that, you know, Tom shouldn't sort of criticize different models, because Radiohead was one of the first bands to, you know, offer an album for free. And a lot of other bands jumped suit, including The More I See. And he pretty much alludes to in a press release that he sent out, saying that, you know, it was one of the worst things that they ever did because no one ever bought the one album that they did release for free. He's also saying that with their new album, they're leveraging Spotify to release an exclusive EP that has three tracks on it. And he's pretty much saying, you know, the whole purpose behind it is to get people to listen to those tracks and go out and buy the album if they're interested. And if not, you know, they have those three tracks to fall back on, and at least they're making some sort of money off of plays from those tracks. And if anyone's interested in buying the rest of the album.
Right. Right. Yeah. It is interesting. You know, I was preaching about Spotify so much, you know, a year or year and a half ago, and I still do love Spotify and I love how it allows me to listen to it. But despite what I said a year and a half ago, maybe even 2 years ago on the podcast, I've now really rediscovered CDs and am definitely enjoying the better quality of audio that you get from listening to CDs now that I'm doing a lot more driving, living in the suburbs and stuff, which, you know, when I lived in Jersey City or Manhattan, I never really drove anywhere. I didn't even own a car for years, you know, and it's like, it's so nice, especially if you have a good sound system. I mean, you know this, Victor, from, I don't know how much you drive in Spain, but you know from living in Jersey, it's just so great to, to just sit in your car and just crank it and just be absorbed by the music without teeny little earbuds just, you know, penetrating your eardrums. You can just feel the, you know, the especially with heavy metal and hard rock, just feel the sounds kind of encompass you, and it's fun to drive and listen to CDs, for me at least. Again, something I haven't done in many years.
Oh yeah, I love it as well. I mean, I have a iPod with 120 gigs of music on there, and I make sure to rip everything in CD quality. So it's more or less, I mean, it's slightly less than CD, but, you know, same deal. I love to just get in the car, crank some, you know, tunes and just drive endlessly, you know, with really no goal at all, but just to check out some cool music and see some nice scenery.
Totally. Bill Lipka checking in. He is listening. Bill, thanks for joining us. Now, Bill, also known as DJ Wiser, he had his own like radio thing going for a while. I remember tuning in once or twice, but I don't think he's doing it anymore. And anyways, guys, you guys are so great spending your Friday nights with Victor and I. And Victor always basically sets up and kind of produces these Friday night live shows. So big thanks to you, Victor, for doing that. And should we check out some more music? What do you think?
Sure, let's do that. Sort of keeping with the theme, we're going to jump into another cover here. This is Machine Head covering Judas Priest, a classic track off of, I think it was Defenders of the Faith, was the Sentinel?
Yes, it was.
So there we go, little Machine Head with the Judas Priest classic, The Sentinel.
Sworn to avenge, condemned to hell.
We are back. And that was a little... I was about to say Judas Priest with the Sentinel. That's Machine Head doing Judas Priest off of their last album.
Yeah.
It's fun. I used to remember listening to NEW late at night in New York.
Right.
And they used to play that song and Love Bites and things like that by Priest. And yeah. It's just so sad that, you know, a band as great as Priest, you only get to hear, you know, 2 to 3 songs out of their whole entire, like, close to 40-year catalog.
Yeah, but on NEW, like you said, they'd only do it late at night. And, you know, it was almost like they were scared to play it during the day. It's like, my memories of that record are, there was this guy, John Nicholson, his name was, and he was in the Hinsdale Central Radio Club. My high school had a radio club and their own FM radio station only, I believe, for my freshman year of high school, and then it closed down. So I kind of was able to get involved with the radio station through this guy, John Nicholson, and the label sent our high school that record. And of course, it ended up in my personal collection. and that is probably one of my first promo albums that I ever got for free. And it's been probably thousands of them since then, having worked at a record store numerous different times in my life. And then, of course, at MTV and VH1, where I just was, you know, bombarded with a bunch of free CDs almost every day.
Right. Well, when I was in college, radio was very similar. And it was funny, towards the end of my involvement, the guy that came in, the new program director, or not program director, I was actually the program director, but the guy that came in that sort of oversaw everything said, well, you know, heavy metal is garbage, so we're going to get rid of all of the heavy metal albums that are in the library. And, you know, me and two other people sort of looked at ourselves. We said, well, what are you going to do with them? We're just going to chuck them in the garbage or break them with a hammer. And we were like, okay, well, how about you let us, you know, have them? Sure, do whatever you want. So, I mean, we were taking home literally boxes of vinyl albums that this guy had no right. clue what their value was or who these bands were. I mean, there was outrageous stuff in there. And this guy wanted to turn, you know, the college radio station into WPLJ. So there were all these like great rock albums even that,
yeah.
you know, ended up going home with one of us because he, you know, he didn't know what he had. And then once, you know, each one of us left, he was like, well, you know, where's Meatloaf's Bat Out of Hell? Well, you specifically told us, you know, you didn't want that because you didn't know who Meatloaf was. So go figure, one of the biggest selling albums of all time. And the guy had no clue what it was.
Craziness. Anyways, yeah, you guys are checking in on Twitter. Thanks for listening. Bill Lipka says that he's letting us know there's some nasty storms rolling through Chicago and the Pearl Jam Fish shows might be stopped because of the storms. Huh. Interesting. Bill, remember to keep talking metal as your hashtag there. And Todd is checking in. Todd, you're such a devoted listener, man. We love you, Todd. Thanks for listening. Todd257 is his handle on Twitter. And he says, what an awesome version of the Sentinel. Hadn't heard that before. Well, thanks to Victor for playing that for you, Todd.
Yeah, glad that he enjoyed it. That was actually a bonus track, but in my opinion, possibly the best song off of that album.
Cool. Well, I'm drinking a beer right now. I want to talk beer with you. I'm drinking this Weyerbacher, Weyerbacher. I'll show you. Can you see it there? We got a camera going between the two of us. Yeah. And it's called Insanity is the kind of beer. I guess Weyerbacher is the company. And it has a little clown on it. This is the most unique tasting beer I think I've ever had. It's brewed like in a wooden, what's the stuff they brew scotch in? Like a cask? Is that what it's called? I'm not sure. But a wooden barrel, I guess. They make beer in, and you can actually taste the wood as you drink it. It's a delicious beer. And if you have a chance, it sounds a little cheeseball-y, insanity, you know. But if you see it, pick it up. High alcohol content and a delicious taste. My two favorite things to get out of a beer. But you sampled some beer this week. Let's talk about that, Victor. Oh, wow. Yeah, he's holding it up on the webcam right now. Awesome.
It is Trooper, the Iron Maiden beer. And it was funny because I was going down the beer aisle in my supermarket figuring, all right, I'm going to pick up, you know, my usual beer. And the first thing that I see is this, and I'll show this to you in another episode or another week, a huge AC/DC beer, which looks almost like a 40 ounce.
Yeah.
I saw that and I said, well, if they have the AC/DC beer, what are the chances that they have Trooper? And right below it was Trooper.
Now, is this like a liquor store in your area there that has just like hundreds and hundreds of beers, or is it?
It's just a supermarket.
Wow, just a supermarket. Wow. And they in the supermarket in Spain, they have the Iron Maiden Trooper beer. That's wild.
It would be the equivalent of a Walmart in the States because it's got clothes, toys, TVs.
Well, that's massive then. I mean, that's big business for Maiden, I would think.
Yeah, I'll get to the selling point in a second, but the first thing that I noticed when I picked this up is that the bottles are plastic. And that was odd. This is the first beer that I've ever tried that actually has plastic bottles. I'm assuming the reason behind that is that you could sell these at a festival or at a show, and they don't have to, you know, bottle with glass, you know, X amount, and then do another batch and with the plastic bottle. So they probably just do them all in plastic just for logistics and to keep, you know, the price down. I know that a few people that I've mentioned this to, they've said that that's a deal breaker for them, that it has to be in glass. So,
and why is that? Why do they want it in glass? Does it affect the taste?
I've always heard, for example, glass to the cans, for example, that it's a different taste for the beer. I mean, there are people that argue that the draft version tastes different to, you know, the bottle or the can. But I'm going to be honest. For example, a few years ago, they started selling Coors here in Spain. And to me, that was a big deal because it was a beer that I would drink from time to time in the States. So you have sort of a taste for it. But in the end, the actual water has more to do with the taste than the container does, in my opinion, because in this case, the Coors that you're drinking over here in Europe, for the most part, is bottled in England. So they're using English water as opposed to U.S. water. So the taste is slightly different. The Coors that they sell here is actually slightly stronger tasting, and I believe that it's a result of that. And it could also be that, you know, the English may be used to drinking stronger beers so that they're, you know, sort of tailoring it to that audience. But getting back to the Maiden beer, it's made by Robinson Brewery. On the back, it specifically says that Bruce Dickinson was the one that had a hand in setting the beer up and tasting it and doing all types of feedback with them to sort of get things, you know, in the right manner to represent the band, I guess you would say. The beer, and, you know, for lack of a better term, it's very, I don't want to say that it's light, but it doesn't have like a strong abrasive taste going in. But it does have like a slight after kick to it, which is sort of reminiscent of a Bass beer or of a Newcastle even, where with the Newcastle, it's sort of, you know, strong up front. But this is very smooth going in, and you get that, you know, for lack of a better term, that after kick after taking that swig. So I found it very interesting. You know, I like the beer. It's 4.7%. alcohol, always something
which is
important.
not a lot,
absolutely, because what I was purchasing at the time, what I usually buy is Carlsberg, which is 5.2, if I'm not mistaken, and then there's a Spanish beer which is called Voldam, which is 7.2, which is the most you can purchase here in Europe.
Insanity beer, I don't know if you can see that, it's 11.1 alcohol.
Wow,
which is high for a beer. I mean, a Scotch. Yes. What is this like? If your average Scotch is like 40 to 45% alcohol. So, you know,
11 is comparable
is high.
Wine, yeah. It's a lot more similar to that. Like beers that are mass produced, you have Samuel Adams, I know, has put out a batch, a specific beer that was 11.1 as well, but that was with a limited run. But for the most part, everything is in the neighborhood of about 5. So I was surprised that this was, you know, 4.7. The biggest issue in my opinion is the actual price. The price of the beer is €2, which translates to roughly $2.65 per bottle.
Yeah, it's high. It's definitely a little high.
Yeah, the AC/DC was the same thing, but like I said, it's almost a 40-ounce.
Yeah, interesting.
So I mean, you're getting a lot more beer for what you're paying. Actually, now that I think about it, it looks a lot like the Foster's can. So I'm not sure if that's 40 exactly. That may be less than 40.
Yeah, I don't know. Probably less. I mean, a 40 is a big freaking bottle of beer, you know?
Yeah.
But anyways, yeah, I used to drink 40s. Back in the 90s, the whole Snoop and Dre thing, you know, it was cool to drink 40s for a while. But anyways, what was the beer that those guys drank?
The Colt 45?
Yeah, Colt 45.
Billy D. Williams there in the commercials way back when.
Yeah, Billy D. Williams.
Colt 45 malt liquor.
Anyways, yeah, we're going to wrap it up, guys. What do you got for the last song there?
Last song is something that actually, let's see.
Because I want to mention something before you play it, but I just was wondering what the last song is.
Oh, okay. I did have Maiden queued up, but I did also have the Detroit Rock City track that Bumblefoot did. I mean, I don't know which one.
Which I don't know. I mean, whichever one you want, man.
Okay. Well, the Maiden is ready to go. So.
Oh yeah, Maiden's cool. I do want to check that Bumblefoot thing out, which Rex Brown on bass. It should be good. But anyways, we're kind of doing these out of order. The next podcast that will be posted is my Vivian Campbell interview. But of course, if you're listening to this in podcast form, it was the last podcast that was posted. I'm talking to the live listeners now, which is just a great interview. If you haven't heard it, check it out. I'm talking to the podcast listeners right now. It'll be, I believe, episode 422 of Talking Metal. And I believe for the first time ever, Vivian Campbell is talking in detail about his time with Dio in a fond way. But I've just been kind of on like a crazy Dio kick lately. And, you know, I mentioned in our last episode, first of all, I wanted to mention something I didn't mention in 422 of Talking Metal, which is that, you know, the whole reason Vivian left Dio, which we already spoke about, I think, on the episode with Ken Pierce, is because of he was fired, basically, after Sacred Heart came out. And he was in a big argument over money with Ronnie James Dio and Wendy Dio. And you know what? This Wendy Dio, the more I learn about her, and I've had a few drinks at this point, so I probably shouldn't be saying this because it's probably going to kill my chances of an interview with Dio Disciples, which are playing in New Jersey Monday, which I can't make anyways. But anyways, I'm just, the more I learn about her, the weirder stuff seems to be. And I don't know, Victor, like if you have ever thought about this or even care, but what was up with their freaking marriage? I mean, was it even real? I mean, I'm starting to wonder what the hell was going on, because we now know that Wendy Dio was running around L.A. chasing young rockers, trying to get hook up with them. Who knows if she went out with one of the guys in Rough Cut? I believe she probably did. Of course, she was probably freshly married to Dio at that point. I don't know when they actually got married, probably late 70s. So by the early 80s, she was already running around chasing guys in L.A. And, you know, Stephen Piercy claims he turned her down and didn't, you know, hook up with her on a sexual level, but he could have. And you know that he wasn't the only one. And this is the early 80s. And then after Dio dies, we hear she marries her boyfriend of 20 years. I mean, what the fuck is going on? What kind of marriage was that? I mean, and why aren't we, like, did Dio have a girlfriend and or girlfriends? And, I mean, what was his deal? It's like, I don't know. I'm very confused by the whole thing. And I now believe that the Ronnie-Wendy marriage, I don't believe it, but I think there's a good possibility. There's something really strange about that marriage.
So it was 20 years that she was with?
20 years. That's what Blabbermouth said. Her long-term boyfriend of 20 years she married. And there's, you know, you can go to these message boards and stuff. I was doing a lot of Googling on this week. And people are saying, oh, he wanted a divorce from her for a long time. Because I remember hearing back, like, I think at some point in the 90s, that he was living away from her in a different house. Like that house Sam Dunn went to do the Dio interview for, what was that movie, Headbanger's Journey? I believe he was living alone in that house, which makes sense if she was living with her boyfriend of 20 years. You know, but right. it's like, what was going on that, you know, people online claim that she wouldn't let him divorce her, but the whole thing is there's something weird there. That's all I know. It doesn't make sense. And you know, they say, oh, well, right before, you know, he died, she was there for him. And yeah, but what the fuck was going on there? And did he have a girlfriend? What was his deal? What was he, just like a loner, asexual type of dude? Did, you know, they never had kids together. She was, you know, chasing, you know, guys around LA, you know, way, way back when, you know, over 30 years ago when they were, you know, freshly married. She was already out on the prowl, you know, looking for dudes. You know, what? I don't know. It's, the whole thing is rather strange.
Absolutely. I've never heard the whole, again, 20 year thing. That's so shocking, you know, that as you're saying that, you know, there was sort of this facade maybe put up, and I don't know, would you think that they stayed together just because he didn't want to split, you know, half of...
It could be. And she may have been tied into, like, a lot of his stuff financially.
Right.
I don't know. I tell you one thing, this book that's coming out that he wrote 3/4 of and she wrote the rest of and probably rewrote what he wrote, that's going to come out in the MTV book print thing, which I think is associated to the VH1 Classic book thing that Ace put his book out on with John. But it's like, I don't even want to read it. I really don't, because I'm not sure I believe it. And I don't like Wendy Dio. There's something about her I don't trust. I think she's weird. I think I don't know if I believe, you know, that she had Dio in her heart on a romantic level, and I don't know, maybe she did on a financial level, but I don't know. There's something very off and strange about that whole situation.
Interesting. Be interesting if, you know, other people come forward after that Dio book comes out to maybe, you know, set some sort of record straight with whatever her accounts are, because, I mean, obviously he's not going to be revisiting anything. But it'll be funny to see, you know, if Vivian comes out or if Vinny comes out. I mean, all of these guys.
Vivian, you got to listen to this interview that I did with him. He doesn't like her, you know, and I almost wonder. You know, he talks about why he formed the Last in Line band, but it's something, you know, and he doesn't get into it totally in the interview, but he for the first time ever mentions Dio Disciples in the interview that I did with him. And he says, you know, why should these guys be out playing the songs? He's like, you know, the Last in Line band is the guys who actually played and wrote the songs, you know, and he is. You know, he's suffering from cancer right now, and he's hopefully going to get better soon. But I think he's all in on this Last in Line thing. I mean, he wants to do a major tour of the States. He wants to take this thing you know, around the country, around the world. And I almost feel like it's because he noticed that Wendy Dio's got this band on the road, Dio Disciples, you know, with numerous different people in and out of the band, you know, right, including Ripper Owens and, you know, Craig Goldie. And I don't know if Rudy Sarzo is currently touring with them or if he's doing the Queens right thing. I don't know. But anyways, I don't know. The whole thing is weird. And I've always just kind of like scratched my head, as I mentioned in the last episode, about the whole Wendy Dio controlling things. And I can't pinpoint everything exactly, but I don't like her and I don't trust her. And I'm sorry that I'm saying that, but it's just, there's something about her that has rubbed me the wrong way as a longtime Dio fan.
Do you think that Vivian is, well, let me ask you this. Do you think Vivian has enough time away from Def Leppard to do that big of a tour with Last in Line?
I think right now Vivian's main priority is his health. He has Hodgkin's lymphoma. He is in treatment for it currently. Def Leppard just played their last show of the year a couple nights ago in upstate New York by Rochester. So he's done with Def Leppard for the year. They may do some songwriting together later this year, but he's done touring, and any work that he does with them for the rest of the year is probably going to be minimal, and it's right, going to be on a songwriting, maybe even recording level. And I think he's got to get his health back 100%, which I think is going to happen personally. And I do think that he is now, which if you listen to this interview I did with him, he's really setting the tone to, you know, he called it, I'm embracing my heritage, and, you know, and that, and I mean, we're talking about, I was asking him, like, what songs do you like off of Last in Line? And he's like talking about Evil Eyes is a great song. And he's going on, like, he's deep into the Dio stuff, especially the first two records, and he's totally embracing it, and he's doing an about face on it. And I do believe it's because now that Ronnie has passed, that he's maybe even mentally able to recognize how great the stuff was that he did with him. And when you hear the interview, you'll hear him, like, he knows it's good stuff now, you know, and or at least he's saying that, you know. I believe he believes it. I believe he just hated Ronnie so much because he felt like he was dicked over on money, you know, which he went into on the Eddie Trunk show, which you can read a transcript on. We don't talk about that in my interview with him. He basically, it was, you know, was claimed that he was almost working for free on those first two albums and tours, and was promised that he would be finally reimbursed and treated well when the third album came along, treated well on a financial level, and he wasn't. And that's where their friendship broke down, that's where their working relationship broke down, and that's where he was ultimately fired from the band. So I think he's pissed. He was pissed about that, and he didn't, you know, he probably doesn't get money from any sales of Last in Line or you know, Holy Diver or even Sacred Heart. He probably signed off on his rights. Who knows? But for a long time, he didn't want to give Dio any credit. But now that Dio's gone, for whatever reason, he's embracing that. He is, and he seems like he wants to crush Dio Disciples. I don't know. It's just the vibe I got.
I would question whether it's his health, maybe him thinking, you know what, I'm not going to be, you know, maybe I won't be around to do this later on, so why don't I do this now? But obviously, Last in Line, the news about this band happened probably about a year ago. And
things have been delayed because of his health, for sure.
Okay. So, but, I mean, maybe it's a little of everything with, like you're saying, him sort of getting over the hurt of, you know, that ruptured relationship that they had, and, you know, maybe his health at the same time, maybe appreciating some of the other work that he's done previous. Because, I mean, if you think of Vivian Campbell, you have to think back to the stuff that he did in Dio, because by far it's his most memorable work. And, You know, I think if anything, out of a fan of his work or an early Def Leppard fan, you think of all the talent that he has and you think of the albums that he worked on with Def Leppard. And, you know, you could almost argue that it's missing that fire and that passion that he did have on those first two Dio albums. But.
Right. Yeah, they were on fire. I mean, he says this. I mean, they were just like on fire on those first two records and tours for that matter. I mean, that was one amazing band. And the guy I want to talk to more about Ronnie Dio and about his time with Dio. You know, we've had him on the show before, but I definitely want to talk about more of the Dio solo years with him is Vinny Appice. We'll get him back on, I'm sure, because John actually is friendly with him. And I'd love to talk with Jimmy Bain, too. I think he'd be a fun interview.
Yeah, absolutely. And Vinny's got a new album coming out, so I'm sure one way or another, you know, he'll make the round.
Are you referring to the Kill Devil Hill?
Yeah, absolutely. So it would have been interesting if you would have had the time to ask Jeff Pilson this whole thing, because obviously he's been in the band, but he sort of wasn't in that first incarnation of the band. But still, I mean, you could honestly argue that Jeff Pilson has actually been one of the more important players throughout Dio's career, because the albums that he has worked on
were friendly. I mean, you know, Vivian actually mentions Jeff Pilson in the interview I did with him.
Oh.
And they were all friendly, Ronnie and Jeff and the Dokken guys, since the Last in Line tour, which is when Dokken went on the road opening up for Dio.
And Def Leppard, if I'm not mistaken, has played with Foreigner in the last few years as well, haven't they?
Probably. I don't know.
Yeah. So I'm assuming that, you know, they still have to be somewhat friendly. And Jeff doesn't seem like a guy that makes very many enemies, you know, he seems to
like
work
a real nice guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Vivian seems like a nice guy to me too. At least he was very nice to me. When you hear the interview, you'll hear it, but he definitely felt like he was, you know, wronged or taken advantage of, by Wendy Dio and Dio for that matter too. And regardless, I'm happy to see him embracing the work that he did on those first two Dio records, or first three Dio records for that matter. And right. Although he kind of downplays Sacred Heart a little bit in the interview, you know, he doesn't really seem like he's into that record as much as I wasn't either. I mean, I like Rock and Roll Children. I like, you know, what was the King of Rock and Roll was on there. There's a few really good songs on that record, but it wasn't quite as special as the first two record. I actually like Dream Evil with Craig Goldie better than Sacred Heart.
Actually, for me, I really love the first album. The second album is really good, but I do really love those first two albums that Jeff Pilson played on. Right. I guess maybe because it was the time period of when they came out and, you know, where I was in my life, you know,
totally.
At the time. Those were albums that came out, I guess, both in, well, it was actually after Dehumanizer, so that has to be like 93-ish, 94, 95, somewhere in that time period. It has to be mid-90s somewhere. And, you know, I love Dehumanizer, and I thought that those two albums were almost like a continuation of that just heavy, in-your-face sound that Sabbath album had. And a lot of that, I think, had to do with that over-the-top bass playing that not only Jeff was involved in, but Vinny's playing was excellent. And I think Tracy G really brought something to the table that was lost since, you know, Vivian was in the band.
Right.
As good as Craig Goldie is on, you know, as a player, I do think that he's a much better live musician than he is a studio musician. With those Dio albums, they're good, but he doesn't really shine as much as maybe the other two that I've mentioned.
Yeah, although, again, I love that Dream Evil record. I think he sounds great on that. And I think it was such an important record for Craig Goldie, coming off of, like, you know, his Jafria stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw Jafria open for Deep Purple, and they literally got booed off the stage. And, you know, I was like a 14, 15-year-old kid on that first reunion of the classic Deep Purple lineup for Perfect Strangers. And I've probably told this story before. I'm not going to go into it now. But anyways, yeah, and they literally were, you know, people were throwing shit at him. It was terrible. And I remember when I met Craig Goldie at the Dio record store in signing in 1986 in Melrose Park, Illinois, I mentioned something about Jafria to him, and he just like cringed and was like, oh yeah, I'm so glad I'm out of that situation. It was interesting because Greg Jafria had kind of some rock cred, you know, with Angel and stuff, and went on to right. House of Lords. But I need to go back and listen to Jafria. They had one song that was supposed to be a hit that never was a hit type of thing. You know, they were right. going for that definitely like commercialized, like Autograph type of sound. But I don't know. They just never really worked.
I actually have a solo album by Craig Goldie. And there's an interesting Kiss tie-in to that. And it's not Greg Jafria, who with House of Lords was under the Simmons Records imprint.
And with Angel was under the Casablanca Records
imprint. That's true. Yeah. The lead singer of the album that Craig Goldie put out, the name of the album was Craig Goldie's Ritual, was Mike Stone, who was later the lead singer of Peter Criss's band for that album, Criss Cat One, who later ended up being in Queensryche.
Very interesting, yeah.
So, and that Craig Goldie solo album actually has a few cool tracks on it, and he has a bunch of other former members of Jafria on there as well.
Really?
So
cool. I'll have to check that out. Cool. Well, we were talking about the Maiden beer. Why don't we wrap up tonight's show with a little Maiden?
Yeah, with a track that is technically a cover. This track was originally put out on the Nightmare on Elm Street 4 soundtrack. It actually has two members of Maiden on the original, which was Bruce Dickinson and Yannick Gehrs. And the track is Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter, which ended up appearing on No Prayer for the Dying later on. Apparently, Steve Harris has heard the track and said, no, that song is too good of a track for it not to be a Maiden song. I personally like the original more. It's maybe a rawer track, but this is still a pretty cool version all into itself. So let's get into this and just thank everyone for listening to the show and checking in with us on Twitter and Facebook and all that great stuff. And hope to see you, if not next week, in the coming weeks right here on another edition of Talking Metal Live.
Yeah, I enjoy doing them. Hopefully we can do one next week. That's a good plan. Let's...
It's getting close to midnight.